Welcome to ABA on Tap, where our goal is to find the best recipe to brew the smoothest, coldest, and best-tasting ABA around. I'm Dan Lowry with Mike Rubio, and join us on our journey as we look back into the ingredients to form the best concoction of ABA on tap. In this podcast, we will talk about the history of the ABA brew, how much to consume to achieve the optimum buzz while not getting too drunk, and the recommended pairings to bring to the table. So without further ado, sit back, relax, and always analyze responsibly.
All right. Welcome yet again to ABA on Tap. I am your co-host, Mike Rubio, along with Dan Lowry. Dan, how you doing?
Looking forward to collaborating with you today on a good podcast.
Pun intended. Today, we're going to talk about collaborative treatment. I know it's a very, very lovely phrase, something that we all aspire to do, something that's difficult to achieve in terms of time and scope of practice. Scope of practice, something that we'll be focusing on probably a little bit today, to say the least. Dan, let me quickly turn it over to you and ask, who is it that we aspire, claim to, really wish that we can collaboratively treat with in our day-to-day work?
Yeah, I think it's a multitude of people. Number one being the parents or the guardians of the individual.
Very nice.
That's the first. Then going to the teachers or anyone, the day program coordinator, whoever that individual is getting education from, residing with, etc. But this time or today, I think we're going to focus more on other medical professionals, things like occupational therapists, speech pathologists, psychiatrists, psychologists, those sort of medical professionals. Because if you look at just medical profession, right, things are very truncated and broken down very specifically. Like, I remember when I was having some medical issues, there was thoracic doctors and vascular doctors and things like that. And it's like, well, wow, that's very specific, is into one sort of thing. But what we do is we deal with behavior. So that begs the question, how specific do we need to be, and where does our competency lie? Because almost everything that an individual emits is behavioral. So where does our competency start and where does our competency stop? I think it's pretty clear where our competency starts, but where does our competency stop when it goes to behavior? So that's our thought. That's what we're going to ponder today. And let me pass it back to you, Mr. Mike.
So if we consider one of our many prospective collaborators, occupational therapy, which part of their job is not behavioral? You make a really good point in passing it back here, in the sense that anything that an individual emits is behavior, but now we're talking about scope of practice and content expertise. So from an OT perspective, we're talking about something we just talked about in our last episode, this idea of sensory motor integration or disintegration, as it were, and how that might affect an individual's behavior. So a lot of times we might get the idea of a child who cannot sit still in their seat, and the notion that a fidget or some sort of nubbly cushion that tilts their core a little bit or their balance over a little bit might work. Behaviorally speaking, a lot of times those things end up being distractions for us.
Sure.
How, again, I know that the OT had no intent of bringing extra distraction into us behaviorally. These are tools that they've been taught are going to stimulate and or engage some level of the sensory motor system, something that from a developmental perspective maybe should have been resolved by about age 24 months, but still has pervaded into this kid who's now kindergarten, first grade, second grade, and not able to sit in their seat and attend a whole bunch of other ocular and auditory behaviors that are probably involved with that. I make my point. It is so layered. Where do these things come in conflict? Yeah, what's your opinion or what's your experience thus far? Where does our scope begin? Where does it end with regard to, say, a brushing protocol or some sort of sensory diet? Where do those things become dangerous for us behaviorally, where we kind of go, oh, I can't believe you just did that as a consequence to that, because it reinforces this inadvertently while we know that somewhere, for example, a very skilled OT is saying, yes, but we have to develop this or that sensory system, so on and so forth.
Yeah, so you asked a couple questions there. I'm going to answer them in reverse order. The first one being, when does it become dangerous? From a behavioral perspective, I think it becomes most dangerous when they're done retroactively. So when a teacher says, okay, it's time to do homework, and then the kid's super overstimulated, and then the teacher's like, okay, you don't have to do homework, go get your sensory diet, so you get the negative reinforcement of avoiding the homework and the positive reinforcement of all the things that the sensory diet partakes. So I think first and foremost, it becomes dangerous when it's done reactively instead of proactively. That was the last of your questions. The first one, I think where we might differ from occupational therapy is kind of the premise of why the behavior is being emitted. So we're all clearly dealing with behaviors. I think occupational therapy would acknowledge that as well. They typically look at it from like you said, sensory motor, so tactile, vestibular, and proprioceptive context, where we tend to look at it from a history of reinforcement context. So we kind of get going down different paths to begin with from there. And I think you brought about the behavioral part with bringing the ball, maybe like a yoga ball or something like that for a child to attend better in school. And like you've mentioned as well, that occupational therapy is heavily evidence-based for a lot of things, which we are not experts at, 100%. I'm not an expert on trying to figure out how to teach a child how to manipulate their fingers to grasp a pencil, how to chew or swallow things appropriately, how to position their arms so they can scooterboard around or balance and things like that. Those motor development things, I am nowhere near an expert in, and occupational therapy is definitely experts in that. Where it gets a little bit extended past potentially their competency and our competency is the behavioral aspect, which we don't need to beat a dead horse. We've talked about that. So bringing that full circle, I think where we can collaborate is acknowledging their level of expertise in the actual movements and specifically how to target it. And we can then work on the behavioral strategies that we can get their trials in. So what I mean by that is they want the child to hold their arms at 90 degrees and push. I wouldn't know that's what a child needs to do at a certain age, but I know how I can create a preference assessment to get that child to be more likely to partake in that activity, how we can fade it into more trials and things like that.
So our task analysis behaviorally becomes 1,001 ways to make your arms go at 90 degrees and push. And then furthermore, how do we make those things happen without otherwise interrupting some sort of behavioral contingency that we might be working on? Right. That's a really good way to put it. I think that's ideal and not something that's always easily achieved, but something that if we all embraced, as it were, it means that in that particular condition, we're putting ourselves aside in a sense and saying, I'm going to make sure that because your content expertise from a sensory motor perspective say that this is appropriate, now behaviorally, I find every way to motivate that particular motion, action, behavior. And in that sense, I'm putting myself aside. I am making sure your needs happen during my work.
And you brought up 101 ways to, scooterboard, for lack of a better term. And I do want to give occupational therapists credit, at least in my limited experience. They're far more creative than most of the ABA practitioners on finding those 101 Amen. Ways. I think where we can come in is the child doesn't want to get on the scooter board. What are we going to do in that situation? The child's not attending. You've got those 101 ways, and the child's picking zero of those ways.
Make one happen.
How do we make one of them happen, which, has kind of manifests its way into IEPs and things like that, whereas occupational therapists might come in and say, we're the behavioral experts, or schools will look to them as the behavioral experts. And that's where, again, competency and lines might get crossed, or occupational therapists might even kick a child out because they're not attending enough or they're not participating on the scooter board, so they're not able to run their trials, which begs the question of, well, if you're the behavioral experts in the school IEP, why are you not able to behaviorally get them to do whatever you want them to do in the occupational therapy session and have to resort to kick them out. So that's why I think that's where we come in, and we can all be utilized, you know, collaboratively. And they can come up with the drills and how they want them to get done and the specific targets and knowing developmental progressions and things like that. And we can come in to say, okay, if those things aren't working, how do we come in and troubleshoot and problem solve those situations?
You just covered a lot of ground there, and I hope I can do it justice and recap really quickly, because what we're saying from a practical perspective, we see this more often than any of us would like, and I'm going to speak for speech pathologists as well as occupational therapists. We know that at the base of some level of aggressive behavior is usually a lack of vocal behavior, for example. I can't talk, so I'm going to demonstrate my needs in some other very effective way, like spitting on you. Wow, look at you gave me attention right away. That worked beautifully, right?
Pulling hair is another good one.
Right, and or some sort of sensory piece. So we know that at the heart of those behaviors lies some skill deficit that both OTs and SLPs are experts, much more than we are, at developing and cultivating. Yet we get into this conundrum of, well, but they're not sitting for us. They're not jointly attending for us. So now, while we thought we were at the heart of this behavior problem, and sometimes even to the disparagement or the breakdown of collaboration and saying, well, no, we know what we're doing. Again, not to speak disparagingly, but we often get into these conditions of, you know, having to defend our behavioral protocols where we should be collaborating more, but it's usually we're defending because somebody's saying, don't do that, mom or dad, do what we want first. But then often we find ourselves on the winning end of, hey, inherit the client now, fix their behavior issues because they won't sit for us to do the work that we claimed at the root of the behavior problem, which we're now we're asking you to fix. I'm speaking a little bit facetiously because we face this condition more often than we'd like. I know that nobody in, not parents, not SLPs or OTs, want to be in this circumstance, but then we inherit this bigger problem. Let's talk a little bit about that and where we might be able to improve or work more collaboratively, knowing that as I speak, I know that as a behavior analyst, I need to be a little bit more accepting of this great role that's been bestowed upon us, which is now, hey, behavior analyst, well, they're having bad behavior. Fix it. Make them sit for us so that we can teach them language and all that sensory motor stuff, which is the cause of the bad behavior. Wait a minute. How does that work? We're being called in again when maybe we should have been posited firstly, but now we're being called in secondarily. Let's put our egos aside. How do we make this work better? Any ideas?
Yeah. I think you do bring up something important that I do want to touch base on. You said put our egos aside. I feel like in ABA, we seem to always be the last people to get the credit. So we're still looking for our seat at the big person's table. So a lot of times we are the quickest to point out, you know, what other methodologies may or may not be doing, and how we can come in and save the day. So you know, maybe we've got a little bit of a Napoleon complex there. So I do want to acknowledge that. But you do bring up a good point. It's the point of, oh, we're going to teach your kid how to do all these things, and you don't need to worry about the ABA. Oh, no, we can't do it. Now you need to worry about the ABA. It's like, well, maybe the ABA could come in either ahead of time to work on getting that child to sit so that when they're in that occupational therapy session, they're maximally ready to learn all of those fine motor things, which are no less important than the stuff that we're talking about. I don't want to seem like I'm poo-pooing OT, and speech is essentially important as well. But coming to us first, so we can teach some behavioral skills, or coming to us during and working collaboratively, so that we can allow that child to be most receptive to the trials, for lack of a better term, that the occupational therapist or speech therapist will be presenting.
Yeah. And both SLPs and OTs have usually much more controlled settings than we do. And one thing that I will say right off the bat is encourage. It's a matter of speaking, and you just said the phrase, but we all sort of conceptualize it in truth, which is I need this kid to sit in front of me. I like to use my English schoolboy comparison, right, perfectly, and then the trial can happen as executor. And I know that what we all mean is I just need you to be in one place at one time for a sustained period of time for a few seconds so that I can guarantee that you took in this stimulus and then you give me some response which I can record. And that's all we really mean. So that's what I would encourage everybody that's listening right now. This notion that we set up a lot of times professionally, and I think ABA is very guilty of it, you know, and we've talked about it before on this podcast, that we're going to get this ideal condition where the kid's sitting right across from us and it's this perfect chair, and that could happen, and that's great if you're making that happen, but all we're after is that sustained moment of joint attention, right? Yep. So again, knowing that for OT, this is probably happening in these wonderful OT settings with these climbers and these ball pits and these foam pits and all this stuff that is so highly high-level reinforcement that we don't have access to. You know, so again, if you have access to those things and you're expecting that a kid goes through a drill in a way that's much seemingly restrictive, although socially idealized, you're sitting right across from me with your arms crossed and you're speaking in English accent and drinking tea and having finger sandwiches, that's very idealized. Get those repetitions in wherever reasonable and just perpetuate that repetition, knowing that whether a kid's got ASD or otherwise, learning theory applies. Any sort of repetitive encoding is going to lead to some level of learning as long as we've got this level of joint attention. So it's one of those things where, again, I think that it's been kicked back and forth, like you're saying, and nobody really intends to be disparaging of the other, but it's like, yeah, wait, put us first. And maybe a lot of times as behavior analysts, we have taken a step back and said, okay, yep, we're going to take a step back to the OT and the SLP because that's their content expertise, even though we're rearing to have the parent try something for eating or otherwise, and a lot of times there's conflict there that we want to avoid, we don't want to cultivate. But then when those things don't work, immediately it's reverting back to, well, go have the behavior analyst fix the behavior. Obviously, they're not getting their job done. Again, I'm being a little defensive. Maybe my ego is shining a little bit. But it does. It is a little bit professionally frustrating or confounding to be like, well, wait a minute. We could have avoided this at the beginning by just saying, yes, you know, OT or feeding therapist, you need to expose them to this, that, and the other. Let us maybe decide the order in which the parent tries that, unless you've got some other nutritional or flavor texture component, which we're too damn good at task analyze, almost too good for our own good sometimes. So how can we use both of those skills from the beginning to then create protocols that are collaborative from the beginning, where the collaboration thus far, as you describe it, and I think it's very, very accurate, has been a lot about who goes first, who goes second. Collaboration really should be maybe some level of this is together from the beginning. And again, I'm being very idyllic right now. Time, a bunch of other constraints are going to get in the way. But we often practice this volley, this, well, you try first, you fail, now I try, now you try, now I try. And we're sort of putting the parents maybe in this limbo of back and forth. You got some things on that.
Yeah, no, you bring up a good point about the collaboration, because almost all of the reports that I review for our company have a fine motor and a gross motor goal, and that's probably not our level of expertise. So we're stealing from them, they're stealing from us a little bit, as opposed to just, you know, collaborating and saying, as long as we can get this child to sit and attend, the OT is going to deal with the fine motor and the gross motor stuff. As long as... you know, that's their expertise. And in ABA, we're not really experts in any one area. If your kid wants to learn math, ABA is not going to teach your kid math or how to play soccer or fine or gross motor or speech. We're not going to teach them the words. We're going to teach them how to be receptive to learning the words. So that's where we can come in. And maybe we don't need to be consulted first, because if they can do occupational therapy or they can learn math without us, don't have us come in. Just do it as would be done in any potentially neurotypical environment. But once we come in, I think, like you said, maybe more clearly defining the roles and our areas of expertise where we fit in. So we're maybe working with an occupational therapist. And okay, so we're going to acknowledge that we're dealing with the behavioral side of things. And maybe that's kind of where it is, because behavior is such a generic and broad term. We're dealing with the compliance and non-compliance side of things and the occupational. So we're kind of throwing the effects that the tactile, vestibular, or proprioception might be having on the compliance and non-compliance piece kind of out the window. As in the same time, we're now throwing out the window the fact that we may know how to teach a child fine or gross motor, because I can work on it and I can get a child to do it, but I have no idea if they should learn how to kick before they learn how to jump, or if they should stand on one foot before they bounce a ball. That is not my area of expertise.
Man, I wish I had written down, or we could live transcribe half of what you just said, because you just made me think of a million things. that are super relevant to what we're dealing with here. In essence, when we put a fine or a gross motor goal in any of our reports or any of our goals that we create behaviorally, what are we really talking about, right? We're talking about fine motor behavior. What does that mean specifically? And then you make the greater point, which is on the spot, all I'm going to remember here. We set up the antecedents or the motivating operations and then further consequate those behaviors that are desired or undesired. That's it. That's it. Which means that we're always having to look, we should always be looking at SLPs, at OTs, at anybody who has any sort of engaging activity, anything that promotes joint attention.
Absolutely.
Oh my God. And just literally pilfering and ripping that off and recreating it and teaching the parents about why it works and then further educating ourselves about why the SLP and the OT want to do it, developmentally speaking, and why those things are important and why they work. I mean, you just made such a layered set of statements that hit upon so many important points with regard to collaboration. Again, a lot of times I think that I keep using this phrase for lack of better phrasing, but I think a lot of it is about the behavior analysts knowing that we get to go into many different environments. Maybe that's an advantage. We sort of have to be the grand collaborators, maybe really embracing the role of being the weavers, right? The ones that bob and weave in between all these different interprofessionally or transdisciplinary members of this team, whether it's school, community, SLP, OT, pediatrician, their psychiatrist, their counselors, psychiatric nurse, whatever it is, doing meds. We don't have a general constant expertise outside of this grand umbrella of behavior, but our professional development should be, ideally, to continually grow these expertise in medication effects, in neurology and neurotransmission, in development, in speech and language pathology, in occupational therapy. We have this really unique role to continually professionally develop in everybody else's roles, knowing that they might come back to us and say, I like the way you put it. Hey, fix this. Hey, make this kid behave the way we want them to behave. We're sort of the auto mechanics of the transdisciplinary team, right? Hey, the car sounds a little funny. It's sputtering. We don't like the fact that it's dripping water. Fix it. You know what I'm saying? You got some things there. Go for it.
Oh, yeah. No, that's... Yeah, the auto mechanic, I think, is spot on there.
I like that analogy. Fix it. Make this sound better. Make this drive the way I want it to drive.
Yep.
You know, whether or not the car works or it's good for the car, make it drive the way I want it to drive. I mean, I'm being facetious there. Yeah.
I mean, we're really experts in one thing, and that's differential reinforcement. So we bring nice. That framework of differential reinforcement, and the skills that the targets and the way that we're reinforcing is, the way that we're reinforcing is partially on us, but definitely the targets and the things that we are providing our reinforcement to should be pretty much picked by the other professionals, the occupational therapist, the speech pathologist, like you mentioned. And I would have never known this without you, and I'm guessing you got this maybe from your developmental psych background, is the old McDonald song in the E-I-E-I-O and the vowels and how those are specifically taught. I would have never had any idea about that. When I teach communication, I just pick a random word because I can teach them one word, and one word's better than zero words. But that's where that, I think it comes back to where, like you said, the auto mechanic, we got the broad skills, but there's, you know, a whole lot of specialty mechanics, a whole lot of, you know, we're the family doctor, that comes in, and if, you know, there's a lot of, more specialized doctors that we could send, the child to get the specifics. We just come in with our differential reinforcement and say, all right, if we reinforce this, the behavior will increase. If we reinforce something else, it'll decrease. Now, you as the content expertise, figure out what this is, whether it's in math, and it's saying, okay, we're going to reinforce 4 when we say it's 2 plus 2, and not 9 when we say what's 2 plus 2, or we reinforce certain positions of jumping, or arm angle, or certain vowel sounds. That's in my idea, kind of where we come in. We come in with the framework, and we come in there to troubleshoot when the framework's not being done.
Let me take a little time on a tangent with old McDonald's. Because without knowing, you've just brought up one of the better examples I can think of off the top of my head of how these things collaborate developmentally speaking. And I appreciate you alluding to that. One of the things I'm very proud of that happened by happenstance in my career is that I'm a developmental psychologist by training first. I did a lot of brain imaging work for graduate study and then got my certification. So it all sort of comes full circle. And I like that you bring up Old MacDonald because I learned that from a speech pathologist. And then I was able, with my developmental background, to expand that for her and then behaviorally think about where we fit in that chain. So when you think of E-I-E-I-O, and you think about the mouth movements that you're making when you say E-I-E-I-O, you're literally going horizontal, vertical to circular. If you think about motor development from a fine motor perspective, and you think about your scribbling programs or your targets for what you want kids to do, you want them to do a vertical line, a horizontal line, and a circle or a cross because of midline, right? Are those things just by happenstance related? No, they're actually the exact same parameters of development from a fine motor perspective, which allows us to connect the importance of fine motor activity and speech language output. Because if you can do E-I-E-I-O with your mouth, you can now create just about any mouth shape necessary to create any morpheme within the English language or any related Latin Romance language that might have similar sounds. Developmentally speaking, we know that socially it's very important for you to now have animal sounds and know what the animal sounds are and know what a farmer does and to do that during circle time from a social perspective while the rest of your peers are doing. And somewhere in there, we promote or motivate the recurrence of that behavior so that those fine motor movements from a finger and mouth perspective and social perspective can now be perpetuated. And now a kid sings Old MacDonald during circle time in their preschool class, and nobody thinks anything else of it than this kid is fitting right in with their peers.
Yep.
That's a really wonderful example of what this collaboration really leads to, is everybody's working on something. And it could be the exact same song.
Yep.
But somewhere in there, it's our job as behavior analysts maybe to keep that song interesting from a motivation perspective so that it happens again and again and again and again. Maybe there's other ways to make those sounds or those mouth movements happen. Maybe there's other way. There are other songs that talk about animals and their sounds. There's a, you know, we're on our way to Grandpa's farm. Again, a million nursery rhymes and what they call finger plays for that very reason. We're coordinating large and gross motor movements, knowing that from a proximal distal cephalocaudal developmental perspective, we need to resolve our gross motor before our fine motor comes online. Somewhere then the OTs take over, that all comes into language, and we're supposed to promote it and motivate it. That's a lot. That's a lot to get done during an 8-hour workday where we all have clients to see, very little time for phone calls.
So, yes. So, number one.
Thank you.
I don't know how I'm supposed to follow cephalocaudal.
That just means head to tail, baby. Head to tail.
Any sort of respect. Number two, you bring up the point, which I kind of want to wrap this up, because I do want to talk more about how we collaborate with psychologists, psychiatrists, and medication providers. Is that you mentioned, so we're going to say that a child has school for X amount of hours, and then they come home, and all of these sessions are compartmentalized, right? They go to speech, and then they go to OT, and then they go to ABA. And that, in best case scenario, is a really long effing day for this child. In worst case scenario, they're going to have to cut one of them out. And that's where, you know, in ABA, we always say it's easier to change our behavior than change others. So rather than say, I would love for an occupational therapist to allow us into the session so we can do our behavioral stuff there, maybe it's easier to have occupational therapists come into the ABA session or speech pathologists come into the ABA session. That's probably what collaboration looks like, because, you know, ABA historically was, you know, in a room, and that was the ABA session, and then they went to a different room for the speech session, and then they went to this fun gym for the OT session. I think we need to start morphing those into one session, where they're learning how to talk. Maybe the speech pathologist is there with the occupational therapist, so while the kid's swinging, they're learning how to talk. And if the kid runs away, the ABA practitioner is there to figure out how to get the kid back into the session. So it's all kind of collaborative instead of three different entities, which the parent isn't even necessarily sure what does what, because they get a diagnosis and then they get all these services and they're like, call these people. And everybody might be stepping on everyone else's toes to try to get more funding. I don't know. You know, and I'm not saying ABA is any different than any of the other ones. ABA might absolutely be stepping on toes as much, if not more. I'm saying maybe we could have one session with everything going on, and then it's a lot more collaborative, it's a lot more functional, it's a lot more time efficient, probably a lot more productive for that individual.
Wow. You followed up very well, even though you didn't say cephalocaudal or any sort of multisyllabic, fancy, you know, Latin-based words.
I try not to be caudal.
but you really covered a lot of ground there. And you know, there are no particular answers here other than what we've been talking about. People taking a step aside, people saying, okay, wait, you tell me what to do with regard to large and gross motor. I'll just make sure that that happens perpetually. You tell me what sounds or words or they should be hearing, reading, looking at, writing, you know, to talk about another collaborative effort, right? The idea of writing is a very nice collaboration between OTs and SLPs, I would imagine. So that from behaviorally now, we're saying, give us your arsenal. This almost makes our job easier.
Yep.
You tell us what activities. You tell us what motions, maybe some activities. Maybe we have to make up the activities because we're just telling us what motions have to be done. Maybe you just say the arms have to be in a certain position. We come up with scooter board. Maybe you tell us, whatever. It's collaborative. But that means that we're, you know, in many ways where we might say, well, you're telling me what to do. The answer might be, you're telling me exactly what to do. Thanks.
Exactly.
I'll just worry about the reinforcement. Making these happen. So now you've given me a whole menu of things. And as soon as a kid orders one piece, I just make that happen. And then I make the other one happen. And maybe this one happens a few times. I don't have to worry about that. I've got a whole menu of things that need to happen. I'll just let the kid pick, for example. And then once those things become familiar, they might become a little bit more reinforcing based on their history or a higher level of reinforcement, to use that a little more appropriately. That breakdown happens somewhere. Somewhere we become separate sessions, we become separate conversations, separate discussions. Let me ask you this. I'm a parent, you're not a parent of a human child. You've got some lovely canine children. Where does that put a lot of our parents? I mean, there's a lot of suggestions flying at them. You know, let's take some time to empathize with our clients here because we're telling them do this, do that, do the other, and then take some really specific data that we're going to graph off.
Absolutely.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah,
It's important. I'm not downplaying it. It's important making it happen better. You know,
that probably puts our parents in a very interesting and precarious situation because, like I said, they get a diagnosis and they call these eight people. The first one they call and get that relationship with is probably the first one they're going to listen to and go by. Or they go on a Facebook group and, you know, we've talked about some of the shortcomings of ABA, for lack of a better term. And then it's like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to go to the occupational therapist for the behavior or the speech for behavior and things like that. And while they can, like we said, by all means, they can bring things to the behavior realm, just as we can bring things to the speech realm and we can bring things to the sensory motor realm, it's not going to be as effective as if we each kind of do our own thing. It's got to be very difficult for parents. I mean, if we as professionals in the field are talking about how everyone fits in and we're hypothesizing, it's got to be way more difficult for somebody who has no idea about anything going on in this field where everyone fits in. Yeah, I think it just comes back to if you look at school and you look at kind of our job is to teach a child to be independent or promote as much independence as possible, as mainstreamed of an environment, for lack of a better term, as possible. I'll take a school term because I'm going to use a school analogy. It would start with mainstream. And then if a child isn't successful in mainstream, they're typically going to evaluate some push-in methodologies before they evaluate pull-out methodologies. Mm-hmm. And right now, we got a whole bunch of pull-out stuff. So your child isn't doing well at home, we're going to pull them out for ABA, and then we're going to pull them out for speech, and then we're going to pull them out for occupational therapy. And all of a sudden, now the child's access to mainstream life is very limited. So the more we can all kind of push in and try to make things be as effective, and maybe that means, again, this wasn't my intention in this podcast to talk about what OTs or speech should do. It's more a reflection of ABA. Maybe that means OTs and speech get more in the home and use things that are going to be more useful day to day. I don't know, but I think if we can all clearly define our roles, collaborate we can be way more efficient and allow that child way more access to highly, you know, good therapy and mainstreamed environments.
That's a really, really interesting point you make in terms of, just to try and wrap this up, knowing that we've got some more ground to cover, and we'll try to give some general summarizing statements at the end here. It's almost like what we all want, these finely tuned, well-rehearsed performances, and what you're kind of saying is we need to go impromptu. We need to make the crowd engaged and laugh, knowing that we're flying by the seat of our pants a little bit, but all of us using our collaborative content expertise in a way that that it's a bob and weave of I'm putting myself aside, letting you take a lead. Wait, now you let me lead for a second, and I'll show you how to behaviorally make that more motivating and make it happen again. But I'll use your activity and do it at a session next time because they seem to like that. But I'll make sure I don't do it too much so it doesn't satiate. And I'll find other activities along with you that are similar. I mean, it's a lot. It's a tall order. And again, we started talking about time and the efficiency of this. Those things don't lend themselves very easily. But I think your point is absolutely precise and correct. That's what needs to happen is, I'll speak for us, a lot more of us putting our, you know, better efforts, better intent aside and saying, okay, let me do what you're doing for a second, or work on making that more motivating, not just for the child, but for the parent too. If it works fast, then the parent's going to be motivated. If I can help you make that take hold quickly, parent's going to do it more, and then we'll give them another activity to do and another activity to do. Now, both of us have the parent working on our side and collaborating. They're the first collaborators for any of us to begin with, right? ABA, SLP, or OT. They're the top tier of collaboration. So I like the way you put that. It becomes a lot of we're sort of the what am I trying to think of here? We're bobbing and weaving. We're making the connections. We're the ones that are the glue, if you
will.
We're
the auto mechanics, like you said. I'll just reflect back on that analogy. Could an auto mechanic, you know, do transmission and suspension and all that? Probably.
Sure.
But a lot of auto mechanics are going to send their transmission out to the transmission guy or suspension guy and things like that. You could argue, well, yeah, they're all just parts of metal, and yeah, I guess that is the case. So, but there's, you know, specifics for different competencies, and so that's kind of where we're like the auto mechanic, and the speech would be the transmission guy, and the OT would be the suspension guy, and if
we're almost the automotive engineer,
yeah, exactly. And we're saying, yeah, we can work on it, but there's people that could probably do it better and more efficiently. And what I'm saying is, yeah, the auto mechanic could send the transmission out and the suspension out, and in the meantime, it's going to be a time you're going to have to wait while it goes to that shop and then back. What if it all just gets worked on there at the shop?
Right.
Now, you do run the risk of running over, you know, running into each other and bumping on each other's toes, and that's something that has to get worked out. But you might save a whole lot of downtime and when those things are being shipped and put back together if everything can just be worked there in the shop.
We are in a unique position professionally, without divulging too much information, to be in a very collaborative circumstance that has worked for us in the past. I think that we will prospectively explore a lot more in the future. But we are behavior analysts within a psychiatric setting, in a sense, historically speaking, and otherwise treatment. So we have a lot of common or co-treatment between us and psychiatric efforts, psychiatric nurse efforts, let's be specific, medication. Let's talk a little bit. Well, let me plunge right into that. I'm going to pass right over to you because you've been driving this from the beginning. I was focusing on the other SLP OT piece. Go for it.
I think that makes a really good part two to this because we're already at about 40 minutes.
Well, let's open it up because I also have a part three to this, maybe, as you know.
Okay.
And it's related to more of the medical application. So let me do a quick anecdote. I remember once being at a case with you, and it was a pretty tough behavioral case. Bigger kid, older adolescent, aggressive with his parents, certainly verbally aggressive.
The one that shoved the big pen in my head?
No.
Oh.
No, more, more recently than that. More recently than that. Was it a pen or a pencil?
It was a big pen.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Pretty good amount of force.
I thought it was graphite. It was, anyway.
No, I act like I have graphite in my head or lead.
So we were in home, and I think I was with you, but you definitely heard about this, And we've been collaborating here with some psychiatric treatment, some meds. And the parents, this kid had an escape behavior where he would fall asleep on us to try and escape the session, right? He would like pretend to fall asleep. So he fell asleep and we were in his room as we had, you know, we had some sort of behavior protocol to try and motivate him from doing the, not doing that. And his parents came in hurriedly and very urgently and were like, oh, we have to wake him up because we've got to give him his sleep meds. And I remember thinking, wow, if we could just talk to your psychiatrist right now, who, well, in fact, happens to be in our building, we might have a different approach on this. So with that little anecdote stated, I think there's a lot more to explore on this. We've maybe touched the very tip of the iceberg on this because we're very fortunate to be where we're at. Dan, I'll let you go on this one.
Yeah, I've got a lot to say. Do we want to touch on the psychiatric stuff on this podcast, or do we want to do
maybe
part
just open
two?
It up really quickly, and then we'll talk a little bit about the other frontier of collaboration, and we can wrap up for today.
Yeah, I think the next thing that we're going to explore is just like where we may or may not be stepping on toes with occupational therapists and speech pathologists and where our competency lies. Being that we are dealing with behaviors and most of the psychological or psychiatric diagnosis mainly manifest through behaviors, where are we or where are we not competent? So if a parent says, my child has ADHD, anxiety, depression, etc., all diagnosed based on behaviors, even autism, are we competent in dealing and rectifying that behavior, or do we need to outsource that to somebody who maybe has more training on the mentalistic approach of that?
Wow. Yes. No. you just talked about so many pieces there. And this is definitely, I like the way you did that because it ensures that we don't continue on this discussion and we save it for a part two. And I think a lot of this has to do with how consumers perceive our specific roles and responsibilities in these co-treatment settings, okay, which is probably a part four, right? The idea that we're newer to the medical table and unfortunately still trumped by the idea of medication. And I would bet that a lot of marriage family therapists, a lot of counselors feel the same frustration we do. And I say that with very clear reverence and relativity. I have nothing against medication. If you had talked to me 20 years ago in my career, I might have had a different opinion. There's nothing wrong with medication. I think that from a consumer perspective, how people regard the effectiveness or efficacy of medication versus what we do and how those two things combine is a whole separate ball of wax that we will certainly get into. Before we summarize, knowing that we've got a few minutes, another area that puts us into that medical practice that I do want to explore in the future, and I'm very interested in exploring professionally. So anybody out there who knows a little bit more about this, please feel free to reach out. About 10 years ago, very, very respectable, very awesome behavior analyst by the name of Pat Fryman released an article, did a publication. I don't know the full title, but I know it's called Come On In, The Water Is Fine. And he's talking about behavior analysis in the mainstream. And his particular idea in there is this idea of behavioral pediatrics, which is right now we're almost mutually exclusive to autism spectrum disorder, meaning that despite the fact that we're using a theory and a set of procedures that also apply to typically or neurotypically developing kids, that crossover doesn't necessarily happen. So we're seen as exclusive to ASD, where a lot of the procedures we use could be applied to younger kids who otherwise get referred out for ADHD, anxiety, because they're wetting their bed. So I really want to look at how we might use this podcast, our own professional endeavors, to move that collaboration forward with regard to pediatrics.
Yeah, very, very relevant. And if you get to share a quick anecdote about my psychiatric premise, I'm going to share a quick one on the behavioral pediatrics because it's very relevant right now with COVID. And I have two clients that I can think of off the top of my head, very difficult getting the COVID shot. One client had to go back multiple times to get the COVID shot, and the nurse wasn't really sure if they would be giving it or if the parent would be giving it, kind of how to go about that. And those could have, you know, fairly serious health side effects to that child. that child's family, also affect that child's ability to access school if they get COVID. So I think that behavioral pediatrics is especially relevant, or it could be brought to the forefront really now when we're talking about how important medical stuff is within the realm of a child's ability to access their environment.
I think what you're saying, Dan, is that all behavior analysts should become proficient in phlebotomy.
Phlebotomy. Man, that's...
We should do blood draws and injections. That's what we should be doing.
Absolutely.
Anyway, that's for a whole other episode.
Take data.
ABA and vaccines. Wait a minute. Oh, no, I didn't mean to say that. All right, just to wrap up for today, we're at a perfect 45-minute mark. I think a lot of what you and I learned today is, and I'm sorry to prospectively offend any fellow colleagues, but maybe our egos are a little too big. Maybe we need to actually inflate our egos a little more and look at ourselves as sort of the interweavers, the glue to a lot of this transdisciplinary team, knowing that every other member of an IEP team that's transdisciplinary would be dealing with behavior, for example, right?
We're the general contractors of behavior.
Yes.
We go out and outsource everybody.
Not plumbing,
sure
not the electricians. We make sure the whole car has to run. The whole house has to be okay. I like that.
Yep.
I like that. That's going to be a mantra or a theme that we'll adopt here, I think, for future use at ABA on Tap. We're the automotive engineers. We're the general practitioners in terms of medicine. We don't have a specialization outside of behavior, but that's a very general umbrella.
Yep.
But I think that what we learned here, I mean, and you made some really good points. Let's take from those activities. Let's take from what those other people are doing. Make sure that those things are being perpetuated, being repeated, that the parents understanding why, that we're building our constant expertise, whether it's in administering vaccines prospectively or phonemes and the development of different morphemes, the development of fine motor skills, fine and gross motor skills. It's a call to arms in terms of our professional development and our ongoing learning as behavior analysts.
Yep. So I look forward to next week's podcast, either ABA and psychiatry or ABA and phlebotomy. We'll figure out where we're going to go with that, but we'll see you all next week. And as always, analyze responsibly.
Cheers. Please do. Cheers.
ABA on Tap is recorded live and unfiltered. We're done for today. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. See you next time.